That's the Paul Chambers Quintet with I Heard That from Chambers' 1959 album, Go. Paul, of course, is on bass. Freddie Hubbard, who just opened up, on trumpet. Cannonball Adderley on alto sax. Wynton Kelly on piano. And Jimmy Cobb on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, January the 22nd. 2015, and House Speaker John Boehner announced yesterday that he has invited Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress on Iran and the threat, he says, of radical Islam that was scheduled initially to be on the 11th of February. It is now rescheduled to March the 3rd. Boehner's power play and breach of diplomatic protocol, because President Obama was not informed, signaled a bare-knuckles partisan fight to the finish of Obama's term. But our guest, Janet McMahon, managing editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, says both Boehner and Netanyahu have confirmed the power and influence of the Israel lobby in the United States. Janet, so nice to have you with us again today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you so much. Well, it is, in fact, a very nasty breach of protocol, I would say. One president agreeing to literally be in the house of government of another country without informing the president of that country, the head of state of that country. And true, yes, it is a very nasty breach of protocol there. But what do you read of John Boehner's invite?
Well, from recent reports that I've read, it looks like this invitation has been in the works for a while. One report said that at Netanyahu's behest, Israel's ambassador to the U.S., who used to be an American, approached Boehner and other House leaders with this idea of inviting Netanyahu. And so, according to some reports, the invitation, the deal was made, let's say, as early as the 8th of this month, January 8th, which was well before the State of the Union address. So that makes it even more intriguing, I think, when you consider Boehner's expressions as he was listening to the president talk about Iran and knowing that he was going to be publicly inviting Netanyahu the following day.
The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, also known as AIPAC, it is considered the most powerful lobbying group in the United States, has its annual convention on March the 1st, and it ends on the 3rd, the very day that Netanyahu is now rescheduled to address Congress. Is there some kind of a tie-in you see here?
Yes, I think so. I mean, Netanyahu has, I guess, often, not always, but one way or another, he makes an appearance at the AIPAC conference, if it's by video, but often in person as well. So I think they're kind of backtracking because they got a lot of criticism for this move. And so now they're making it seem like, oh, well, he's going to be here anyway, so he can come and speak to us while he's already here, and trying to tone down the kind of the insult in the way it was initially handled.
What do you, as the editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, what do you think of the significance of this this effort to have him physically present in Congress, a joint session of Congress at that?
Right, and this would be his third appearance before a joint session of Congress. He's done it before, and in fact, when he was here in 2011, also shortly after the State of the Union address, he got more standing ovations. He got 29 to the president's. When he had his standing State of the Union address, he got 25 standing ovations. So he's used to being welcomed very warmly by the Congress of the United States. Well, but I think the APEC's own
description of its convention this year says it expects to have more than 2/3 of the members of Congress in attendance at its summit. This is quite extraordinary. What accounts for this extraordinary participation by members, elected members of the U.S. Congress, at an event basically given by a lobbying group? They do have March the 3rd scheduled as their lobbying day.
Right. And I think what's significant really about APEC and other components, I think APEC is the kind of the figurehead, the biggest, the most blatant face of the lobby. But it's the point to remember is that this is lobbying on behalf of a foreign country. It's not even like the NRA, which is, I'd say, up there with APEC, but they're lobbying for things that happen in this country and for things about this country. But APEC and the Israel lobby are lobbying in the interests of a foreign country. They're not lobbying in the interests of Americans. But one reason that they are so influential in Congress is that there are a lot of little political action committees, not so little, but and they're kind of coordinated by APEC, and they give a lot of money, a lot of money to members of Congress. And I think that's one of their main holds on Congress is just the power of the money and the influence that they have throughout the country through all these little community relations councils and organizations that are all working on behalf of Israel. And when you put them all together in the same, behind the same cause, you have a very powerful lobby. Well, money is a big part of it.
Let's hear how Boehner explains this invite to Benjamin Netanyahu. Okay, are we having a little trouble with that clip, is it?
Okay.
All right, the clip is not available, apparently. Let's talk about the Israel-U.S. connection. Clearly, there is no great love between both heads of state, Netanyahu and Obama. But what is, in your view, at root of this?
Well, I think that Netanyahu, he's done things like this before. In 1998, when President Clinton was in office and they were going to be doing peace talks with the Palestinians, Netanyahu showed up in Washington and immediately went to a gathering of Jerry Falwell and other Christian Zionists and Jewish Zionists. And in kind of insulting President Clinton, like, I'm going, these people love me and you don't, you know. So there's always that kind of tension there, I think. But I think the real issue, what's really going on right here, is the Iran situation, the Iran negotiations, the bills in Congress that are about Iran. I think it's things that are coming to a head, and there's just a lot of pressure on this issue on both sides. But I think that, you know, the last time when Netanyahu was here in 2011, he basically insulted Obama in public, saying, I'm not going to move back to the 67 borders, and who do you think you are, in effect? So it is. It's a very insulting relationship, I think.
What is the – I mean, it can't be read any other way other than as an insult when – The Boehner says, we need, since you don't understand, Mr. Obama, since you don't understand this problem, we're going to have somebody come in and tell you what it is. And that person is another head of state with which you've had clashes in the past. And that puts now Netanyahu in a position of authority, not just over the president, but over the United States. My view is more important than your view and the collective view of your entire governmental apparatus.
Yes, and I think it's very interesting that the initial reports were saying, oh, Boehner has upstaged Obama, I mean, by inviting Netanyahu, as though Americans want to hear what Netanyahu has to say rather than what their own president has to say. I think that's a very faulty premise. You know, I don't know how many Americans are just sitting at home with bated breath to hear what Benjamin Netanyahu has to say about Iran.
But
I mean,
it's not
I
like
think all
Benjamin
polls show
Netanyahu
that the U.S.
is all that popular also in Israel. I mean, he's had his fair share of criticisms in Israel itself.
Right.
And they are many people are very upset about this hard line that he has taken. And in fact, in the recent his recent trip to Paris during this Charlie Hebdo attack, where he was actually asked by the president of France, Hollande, not to come. He decided to go just the same. He, Haaretz, the leading paper, wrote an account of Netanyahu not only barging in, but also making himself going to the first bus where he was not supposed to be.
Then
moving aggressively into the front of the line, simply to be seen. But just the same, one could say, well, this is a very dogged individual who is absolutely committed to his political philosophy, and he has basically done what he said he was going to do, and he's committed to doing that, no matter whether people agree with him or not.
Yeah, that's right. And he is going to be facing re-election on March 17th. So that is 2 weeks after he's making his joint appearance, his appearance before a joint session of Congress. So he's got electoral politics in mind as well, I'm sure.
Let's talk about the connection of AIPAC and the role of AIPAC in facilitating, as you say, it's for all intents and purposes, it's a lobbying group. It is, in fact, facilitating a lot of intervention and influence in behalf of Israel. How important has AIPAC been to Israel's existence and continued financial support from the United States?
Oh, I think it's been crucial. I mean, because of AIPAC's influence in Congress, let's say, for example, we give Israel $3 billion a year in military aid. And recently when Israel was attacking Gaza over the summer, Congress passed something to give them more, to replace the weapons they were already using and give them more money for their Iron Dome fund. So that's a direct connection where you have AIPAC pushing for this legislation, and they even write some of the legislation. So they're very, very hands-on, let's say, in Congress and among members of Congress. And I think one consideration Boehner may have had, he wouldn't, if he gets all the Republicans to vote on the Kirk Menendez bill to increase sanctions on Iran right away, he doesn't have enough Republicans to override a presidential veto. But if Netanyahu appears here and he can get some Democrats to come over to his side, then he's in a much stronger position regarding that bill, which the administration opposes and also Israel's Mossad opposes. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot at stake.
What is the particular concern of Israel with respect to Iran?
Well, they would not be the only nuclear power in the Middle East if Iran had a nuclear weapon, too. And I think it's just insane to think that Iran would attack Israel with nuclear weapons. At best, it would be a deterrent. But Iran has said it doesn't want nuclear weapons. It wants to make its own electricity. It's doing everything it's entitled to do by being a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And Israel has not even signed that treaty. So Iran is not breaking any law, it's not violating any treaty, but it's being treated like a pariah because Israel wants to be the only nuclear power in the Middle East. It doesn't want, I mean, obviously it has an agreement with the United States that the U.S. will guarantee that Israel is always the superior military power in the region. And I think that's what's really underlying Israel's efforts. It's not fear that Iran will attack them.
But it goes beyond this as well. The feeling is that Iran, in the dynamic that is fast unfolding in that region with ISIS or ISIL, whichever it is being called now by Washington. The Islamic threat, the Islamic terrorist threat, has been growing, and Israel sees Iran as a kind of having a little bit too much power in terms of ameliorating how this question is going to be handled, how the negotiations might occur, if any, and Iran is a pivotal, plays a pivotal role or can play a pivotal role in the region, basically setting aside the United States, which everybody, most everybody hates in the region, right. Setting aside Israel, which most everybody in the region also hates. So Iran has also used its leverage to increase its profile as a political power player in the region.
Yeah, I think Iran feels it's entitled to be respected as a major regional power. It's a huge country. It's very influential. And I think it's just like saying France wants to be respected in Europe or Germany wants to be respected in Europe. Iran wants to be respected in that region. And possibly another thing that might be worrying the Israelis is since Iran is a Shiite country and the Islamic State is Sunni Muslims, Iran could be a natural ally of the U.S. in fighting the Islamic State. And I'm sure that is the last thing that Israel wants.
You, at the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, you have been keeping a very close eye on the money that goes from the United States to Israel. Do you suspect that Netanyahu's visit and his address before Congress, if it still goes ahead, over the objections, obviously, of the Obama administration, over the protocol breach, do you think that this is a precursor to a request for even more money for defense?
Well, I think that we were just talking about this a little while ago, that if it turns out that the U.S. does not pass this bill, then maybe Israel will want more money. I mean, we have to pay them for everything that we do. It's always the U.S. that pays. I mean, Israel has not lost soldiers fighting Iraq. It hasn't paid money fighting Iraq. It hasn't gone into debt fighting Iraq. We're fighting those wars for Israel, in my opinion. And so it's got a lot of ramifications for Americans. And Israel is not paying the price hardly at all.
Why is there a hesitancy to bring this question directly before the people of the United States, as it has even in Israel? People have begun to ask these questions in Israel, and there's a great resistance in Israel, although it's not covered regularly. People have problems with this relationship, that the Israel continues to basically look to the United States for money, no questions asked. In fact, Netanyahu has said as much to Obama directly. Do not second guess me, he said at one point to President Obama. Why is there such a hesitancy in the United States, considering the billions of dollars that are given in free aid, and this is military aid, right, and billions more in other than military aid, Israel being the only country receiving aid from the United States that gets its money up front, lump sum? It does not get it in stages. It gets it all at the same time. Why is there a hesitancy to deal with this question? And when it is dealt with, it is usually, we have to do this because Israel, we are tied almost like by an umbilical cord to Israel, and there's no fault with Israel at all, and we just have to, we are if we have to put soldiers on the line, other people's sons and daughters to fight, that's what we will do. And there are no questions to be asked about this aid to Israel and this relationship to Israel, which so far looks like very much a one-way street.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Yeah, I think it's interesting that it's much easier to speak freely in Israel than it is in the U.S. And that may be because Israel is afraid that once Americans start questioning this relationship and everything that we do on behalf of Israel, they'll say, forget it. We don't want to do this, and we want you to stop it. I think Congress is way behind the American people. I mean, I think the American people know much more than Congress represents them as knowing. So I think Israel is just afraid that that would be the end of it. You know, I think truth is not their friend.
Do you think that this will go ahead as planned on March the 3rd, or is there going to be some kind of way of saying, you know, this was really a bad move? We really have insulted the not just the president, but the people of the United States. Is this going to work in Boehner's good stead to be situated as a guy who assisted in the insult to his nation?
It's just going to be fascinating to watch. I think if Netanyahu is already going to be here and they can make it seem like it's just a natural thing, if they can kind of cover up the initial mishandling of it, I think he will speak before Congress. I mean, he's done it before. Heads of state do it. I don't know how they're going to rectify the manner in which it was done, except to try and make everybody forget it. But I think at this point it would be awkward if Netanyahu were already here in Washington and then didn't speak before Congress at this point. So I rather think he will. And I think that they want, you know, they've been beating the drums on Iran for almost a decade now. I mean, they don't give up. You know, the lobby does not give up. Their AIPAC, their conference is always about Iran and what a threat it is, and we have to take it out, and it's just that's their cause of the moment. And so I think they'll try and get him there, and I think he probably will speak before Congress.
How does AIPAC dance this fine, or get to dance the fine line as basically a pro-Israel group and not as a foreign lobby group?
Well, there are laws that basically and unfortunately are not being enforced. And there's a whole history of how the founder of AIPAC changed the organization's name, and he didn't reply to demands that he register as a foreign agent, and now the Justice Department doesn't pursue this. I mean, there have been efforts to get AIPAC to lose its nonprofit status, to have it required to register as the agent of a foreign government, and that's also up to the executive branch, the Justice Department, and I don't know if the Treasury Department is involved, but probably the IRS for tax exemption. So these agencies, and they may have pressure internally too, but they don't touch it.
Does any member of Congress that you know of leaning in the direction of saying this is really undue influence? This is overreaching. This is highly questionable, and we ought to begin to take a look at this stuff.
Well, there have been efforts to do that. I mean, Senator Fulbright, who was chair of the Foreign Relations Committee in the 60s, was investigating the lobby. I'm not remembering the name of Robert Byrd of West Virginia. He would be pretty outspoken at times. And I don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but in public and on the floor, there's not much questioning of this relationship. And because part of it is then you're accused of being an anti-Semite, and you get into that whole area. And it's people, they don't want to get involved. And they want to get reelected.
What have you written, what has the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs reported on recently that raises this, that puts this whole thing into appropriate context?
Well, we've always, every 2 years, I guess, with every Congress, we publish a compilation of what aid to Israel has come, what the total aid to Israel is. Every election, we put in how much pro-Israel PAC money every candidate gets, and the legislation and who's behind it. So for example, Mark Kirk, who is one of the authors of this bill, it was so obvious years ago that he was being groomed by the lobby. He was a House member. And he's been very clear. He had a picture on his campaign website. He had his name written in Hebrew in the colors of the Israeli flag. You know, but people don't know this. They don't know that Kirk or that Carl Levin took $750,000 in pro-Israel PAC funds. I mean, we're trying to get all this word out to Americans so that they can see what's going on.
And how could they access this information?
Well, we have our website is WRMEA.org, and we have a section on Congress and the Israel lobby, and so we put all that information in there. And then all 32 years worth of our magazine are online too and available to everyone. So you can even trace the history. Yeah.
I want to thank you so much, Janet, for being with us today and helping us understand, giving us some kind of a context for what this was. I mean, it was just so weird that we would have a head of state essentially coming into the inner sanctum of government, if you will, without even the basic manners of saying to the head of state of the host country, guess what? I've been invited, and these are the arrangements. Are they okay by you? I mean, not to even do that, it seems to me, is just intolerable, and it is typical of the bad manners of Netanyahu, his brash manner, and his arrogance. And I thought, being assisted by John Boehner, we would be hearing howls of protest out of Congress, but so far, not a peep.
I know. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, that's for sure.
Thank you so much, Janet, for being with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
When we come back, we'll talk about the reports that the ex-Ferguson cop, Darren Wilson, will probably not be indicted for killing Michael Brown. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, and of course, you're listening to PRN.FM, of course, you know that. There are reports circulating, and they seem to be they're quite confident in the authenticity of these reports, that the federal investigation of Darren Wilson, the officer who shot and killed Michael Brown, will more than likely not be indicted. And of course, my discussion is about, are you surprised? We told you this right here on this program. We told you that the state prosecution was going to go nowhere. And we told you that the federal investigation was going to go nowhere, that this officer was going to walk away. And it is the same, we said, the same for the Eric Garner case. Alton Maddox and I, we had been discussing these cases in detail and telling you chapter and verse as to why these cases were put on the track of going nowhere in terms of prosecution of the officers involved. That is the typical response, and that has been typical in so many cases. We actually have lost count on such cases where civilians have been killed. I call them civilians. Look, they're people. People have been killed by police officers, and the system automatically goes into defense and or cover-up mode, because it has been determined that those people who are killed are members of a group who you don't need to get all excited about their rights being violated. You don't need to get extraordinarily concerned about the fact that they are dead. We listened to Dr. Martin Luther King tell us that the ultimate aim and objective of racism is genocide. And that sank in my brain, because it is so poignant and it is so true. And we see the apparatus of the state, meaning the police, in every instance, automatically getting the benefit of these pardons up front. They're not aimed for their actions. They couldn't possibly be wrong. But that aside, for the moment, I wanted to make sure that we understand that in this case, the killing of Michael Brown, I am very clear as to where the blame actually also lies. And it is with Sharpton and these lawyers who allegedly are representing the family. Not once did we see in the beginning of this case, where they had the entire situation literally under their control. They controlled the momentum of the case. They controlled the public outcry and outrage about what was done. They controlled to a significant degree, the pace of the case, and they controlled the possibility and potential of how this case could have been handled in order to deliver justice. They were not interested in justice from the word go. And the system agreed. In fact, I would even go as far as to say they agreed with the system. They assisted the system. They supported the system by refusing to confront it. The very first thing, I said it off the bat, the very first thing they should have done was to demand a special prosecutor in this case. How often have I said that? But they didn't do it. And they didn't do it for political reasons and for financial gain. The political reasons were very clear. Al Sharpton was an agent of the government. Al Sharpton came in there to literally appease the people in behalf of the government, because it was more important to him to have a connection with the White House, to rub elbows with the politically powerful, than to actually engage in a struggle for justice. The very name Darren Wilson would not have been known had the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri not filed the papers to compel the city of Ferguson to disclose that information. The lawyers didn't do that. A public interest entity did that. They came in and all of these cameras and big news releases and news conferences and all of this noise. But absolutely no work relevant to the matter of justice. The Their thing was, we will keep everybody in play and we will have it duly noted that we did not excite the people. We did not cause them to go out in the streets. We didn't cause any trouble, sir. So when the time comes to discuss a $75 million lawsuit, you will remember these things and pay us what we are asking. And we will sit at the table across from each other and we will discuss the dollar value of the dead man. And we will leave the table happy. Because whatever it is you say the dollar value is of the dead man, I'll get 35%. Justice? That's another day. That's another discussion for another time. And that is the reason that these cases, the Garner case and the Michael Brown case, were put on the track to nowhere. The deal was cut up front. We're not going to raise any trouble. We're not going to ruffle anybody's feathers. We'll yell about, oh, justice, 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 but nothing concrete will come out of our offices or even out of our mouths to suggest that we are going to engage the system and compel it to deliver justice. Nothing. There isn't a brief with a docket number with their names on it anywhere. And so they're all on the same side. The lawyers, Sharpton, the Justice Department, even the president, the prosecutor, the cops, they're all on the same side. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. And that is why we were able to predict absolutely on point. This is how it's going to go. It's not that I'm, a clairvoyant. It is not that Alton Maddox is a clairvoyant. It is that we've been through enough of these cases. Him as a very extraordinary lawyer, and I covering these cases. You know how it's going to go. And I told you exactly how it was going to go. Go back to the archives and you will see chapter and verse of how we pinpointed in excruciating detail how these cases were going to end. It's not about glory. It's actually a sense of fury because these things are known. And despite the fact that they are known, these individuals who were in a position to chart a different course decided they weren't going to go there. The cases have to serve another purpose. Money? And raising my public profile, which in turn will give me more money. So don't get angry at the government. They're doing what they routinely have done for years. We know how rotten the system is, how corrupt. How wrong. But they're consistently so. That's their nature. But I am saying let's look at the other element here. Because they too have to be called to account. These cases yielding no justice is as a result of their complicity with the system. You can't see it any other way. And we will have come to the point, if in fact the Justice Department does finally say, well, we see no reason, we have no way of determining intent, and they'll get all technical. We couldn't read his mind. There wasn't enough evidence to suggest that he set out to kill Michael Brown. We did not detect any kind of, presupposed notions of race or anything like that. So on technical grounds, we can't possibly indict him. And I said to you before, that's what's going to happen. I also said to you before that the cases were deliberately guided toward the federal government because the federal government would more than likely not yield a result. I said that. I said that the question still remains, why didn't the local systems work? These are two local cases. These are local cases that could easily have been dealt with very efficiently, very fairly at the local level. Why did the local systems fail? And why do people think that it is over? That's also the message here. And all sides are agreeing. Sharpton and the lawyers never said, well, the first grand jury didn't indict, but we insist on a second grand jury. They seem to think, well, that's the end of that. And now we call in the feds because they think the public is so stupid that they would say, oh, well, the feds are coming in. Then it's going to be really serious. The feds are not going to do anything prosecuting on civil rights grounds. This is a criminal matter. This is murder. And the system is very efficient in prosecuting crimes locally. Just look at the jails. And you see how many black and brown faces, mostly men, in the prisons. The system works very efficiently. They know how to prosecute cases and get desired results. This is a local matter. And we are called to believe that in Ferguson, because a police officer is involved, the system suddenly can't take care of it. In New York City, where people are put in jail for all kinds of crimes every single day, including crimes they never did commit, the system suddenly cannot perform its task because a police officer is among the killers. The system still must be compelled to operate. This case isn't over. So they're clearing the decks. They're telling people, well, look, you know, we tried. We gave it a good shot. It didn't work. But as you can see, we made a strong effort. And we talked about those efforts. Those efforts that were designed to give immunity to the police officers. Immunity. Check your podcasts and you will see I talked about exactly that. I said, Officer Darren Wilson got a Thanksgiving gift called immunity. Not only from current prosecutions, but from any future prosecution. They think people don't know how this works. The linchpins here, just the same, are the lawyers for the families and Sharpton. And they are not to escape culpability. It was within their power, their purview, to organize this case in such a way that the system would have nowhere to go. It was their case. It was the people's case, but of course, they didn't think that. They're never about the people's case. This is about pure and simple. This is about the big money at the end of the tunnel. And once we get the money, we will hold another news conference to say justice has been served. They paid up. And the community will go through several more cycles, interminable cycles of death by police and nothing being done. So I'm very clear. I am very clear that no matter what they say, you know, they try to get people all excited about, oh, well, it may not turn out to be an indictment after all. We told you that up front. So don't get all excited. You knew this up front. We told you, and we told you how and why. So you're an educated person. You understand this. This is not a surprise. It should not come to you as a surprise. If you've been listening to this program, in painstaking detail, we spelled out for you exactly why there will be no indictments either at the state level or at the federal level in the Michael Brown case and in the Eric Garner case. The common thread here are the lawyers and Sharpton and their complicity with the system. Don't forget it. You see, we have to deal with the facts. We have to deal with the facts. And we have to deal with the facts in terms of a collective interest. We just heard Martin Luther King himself talk about what he saw as his mission and how he was ready, even at the expense of his life, to take on that mission. He was not afraid, and he knew the possibility was very real that his life was going to be put on the line in the interest of justice. But then you have these jokers, these charlatans, who come before the community and they use the good energy of the people, the earnest desires of the people for change, the sincere effort that they're making to lend to a movement that is beyond themselves, that is in the larger interest. And these folks use that to basically shore up their own private, individual agendas. And they still want people to believe that this is justice. And this goes all the way back to the Trayvon Martin case. Not a piece of paper that says they objected to the appointment of this woman who said, well, I'm going to be the special prosecutor, the prosecutor with the most horrendous history of prosecution in the state of Florida. Not a piece of paper that says I questioned the composition of the jury. I questioned the instruction of the judge to the jury. I questioned the theory of the case by the prosecution. Nothing. And how many more Trayvon Martins have we had after that? Because there's nothing on record that says some lawyer took his job seriously, because the fight for justice is in the court. And here is proof that this lawyer stood up and fought and won. You have people out in the streets screaming at empty buildings. A mockery. They have no idea that they were part of a choreography of contempt. These people and their sincere and earnest desires for change are just looked upon as a bunch of, you know, look what we could make them do. We could make them come out in the hot sun and yell and scream. And then shortly after that, I make a call to my masters and I tell them, well, I kept them in line. I hope you noticed. I kept them in line for you, sir. And then you come out to a black church somewhere and you talk and inveigh the system, and you talk like you're fighting for something and you're not. And that's the problem I have. The system announced a predictable outcome, or will soon announce a predictable outcome. It is not surprising. You know it. But what we need to understand is the unfinished business still to be done. We have to call these people to account. They are responsible. They are responsible for the lack of justice, even for people they say they represent as clients. And they didn't have to go that way. They chose to go that way. They decided that this was going to be treated. The death of Michael Brown was a personal injury case, as far as they were concerned, because that's as far as their talents could take them. They're not bothering to say, well, we don't know how to deal with this as a class action. And maybe we don't want to do it as a class action because there isn't enough money in it. But we could make a quick buck here if we were to just deal with this case as a personal injury case. We keep our tongues between our teeth. We show no intention to the system that we are about to engage it in a knockdown, drag-out fight that we will win. And quite the opposite. We're trying to let them know we're being very compliant, very nice, very quiet. We pose no threat to them whatsoever, so that in the end, we could get the millions. So that's our unfinished business. Are we going to call them out? Are we going to call them out? I want to thank you for joining me today on these two topics. And hopefully, of course, you'll return tomorrow. Hopefully I didn't frighten you away. And you will come back tomorrow for Free Your Mind Friday right here at PRN.FM. You can reach me always at leadstories@gmail.com. On Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Until then, as always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.